Penguin Random House Audio presents 70 times 7, a true story of murder and mercy. This is the author, Alex Marr. For Todd, and then you arrived. Then Peter came to Jesus and asked, Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to 7 times? Jesus answered, I tell you, not 7 times, but 70 times 7. The Gospel of Matthew. Prologue. On a spring afternoon in 1985 in Gary, Indiana, 4 teenage girls enter the home of an elderly woman under false pretenses, and when they leave, she is dead. One of them, a 15-year-old, will soon be sentenced to death for murder. There is no question of her guilt. This is not a story of wrongful conviction. The crime was violent enough to shock the conscience, a legal phrase the prosecutor invokes. And so no voices of protest will rise up in that city or in broader Lake County or farther south in the capital at the impending execution of a 10th grader. Not until a man very close to the victim, her grandson, publicly forgives the girl against the wishes of his family and campaigns to spare her life. Not until the crime is featured on the front pages of newspapers and television programs 5,000 miles away across the ocean, where petitions are signed by millions, does the American media begin to question the outcome of this case. A tragedy in a Midwestern steel town will continue to play out, have its second act, as far away as the Vatican. From criminal court in northern Indiana, the reverberations of the case will eventually be felt in the highest court of the United States. Over the past 5 years, I have read thousands of pages of documents, personal letters, and newspaper features, and scanned through thousands of photographs and dozens of hours of footage. I've conducted interviews with some 80 individuals, culminating in hundreds of hours of conversation. Throughout, I was asking myself about the nature of belief, of conviction, the source of our guiding principles. I've asked myself what our common definition of justice might be, if there is even a shared understanding of the word. Unlike some of the people whose lives and choices I will describe here, I am not a practicing Christian. But I have returned again and again to a moment from the Gospel of Matthew that has special meaning for someone at the center of this story. The moment when the disciple Peter asks Jesus how many times he should forgive those who harm him. The answer is 70 times 7. An enormous number, as if Jesus were suggesting his followers be prepared to forgive an infinite number of times. It is hard to imagine someone who could carry this out. It is hard to know if such a request is even fair. Anger is a very human, instinctual response. The act of forgiveness, I think, is more alien and requires something tougher, a belief that none of us is solely defined by the worst thing we have ever done. That each of us remains human, sometimes in spite of our actions, and that sometimes our actions are a response to forces larger than ourselves. This is a story that asks what any community is willing to accept as just consequences, as justice, for harm done. It is a difficult question, one that each person in this book has been forced to confront, because whatever the answer, its impact will be more sprawling than predicted, hard to contain, whether or not we choose to acknowledge it, in ways very great or very small. The fates of neighbors are linked. Part 1. Chapter 1. The Care of Children. One house of the many that make up a city. A pale yellow house, an hour after sunup in Gary, Indiana. A woman lives here, on Wisconsin Street, with her 2 daughters. Rhonda is 12, her sister Paula is 9. It is 1979. Their mother, her name is Gloria, hustles them outside into the morning light and then into the dark of the garage and the back seat of her red Chevy Vega. The girls are very young and they are powerfully tired. They understand what their mother intends to do. She has kept them up all night, softly talking, then shouting, then whimpering to them about where they'll be traveling together, about what must happen next, and they are no longer resistant. With her daughters inside, Gloria tugs at the garage door until it slides down to meet the concrete. She slips into the driver's side, rolls down the windows, turns the key in the ignition. The engine gives off a deep, thrumming sound. Then she waits for them to close their eyes and fall into that steady rhythm. She can see their faces in the rearview mirror, small and brown and perfect. All three are still, their limbs grown heavy as if underwater. The engine continues running, the minutes accumulate, the air thickens. Outside the garage, the neighborhood is awakening. Inside the garage, the girls are passing into an unnatural sleep. What Rhonda remembers next, she and Paula laying side by side on their bottom bunk, not knowing how they got there. They have not exited the world. Gloria is leaning over them, her daughters. They will be all right, she says, just before leaving. Rhonda does not know how much time has passed before she is able to move her body. She rises slowly. A letter is taped to the door from their mother. She is finishing what she set out to do. Rhonda rushes to the kitchen and calls her aunt, who tells her to run, get their neighbor. Through the window, she thinks she sees exhaust seeping out from under the garage door into the bright daylight. Mr. Hollis drags Gloria out of the garage and lays her on her back on the lawn. He drops to his knees and with elbows locked, hand over hand, pushes hard on her chest. Again and again. The neighbor across the street, a nurse, rushes over and takes her turn trying to pump breath back into Gloria's body. The ambulance arrives, and the fire department, and a medic becomes the third person in line to tend to Gloria. By now, Paula is standing outside, watching. Rhonda sees her younger sister grow hysterical at the sight of this stranger bearing down on their mother's chest, and Gloria, not responding, not responding. Something Rhonda will not forget. No one examines them, the girls, the firemen, the medics. No one so much as takes their pulse. When Gloria is swept off to the hospital, the sisters go stay with their aunt. When after a week their mother checks herself out early, no one asks any questions. When she comes to retrieve her daughters, no one stops her. For years, Rhonda has said that she does not know what transformed her sister. But now she tells me, as if untangling the question aloud, that this was it. This must have been the start of a change in Paula. Because you have to understand, we were all supposed to have been dead. That's what we were expecting. That's what we were hoping. But they were still alive. And what now? Another day in the yellow house? The house stands in Marshalltown, a subdivision of the Pulaski neighborhood, integrated by Black working-class families in the 1950s. Theirs is one of a collection of streets lined with neat, ranch-style homes, single-family, with small front yards. About a mile west of here is Midtown, or the Central District, once the sole, clearly delineated quarter of Gary's entire Black community. And a mile into Midtown is Broadway, which runs north-south the entire length of the city. That four-lane street leads you north into downtown, where the architecture collapses time. An ornate brick department store, now boarded up. A children's clothing store, now boarded up. The former headquarters of a major regional bank, its Greco-Roman facade left to grow tarnished. People still shop here, but more and more, steel accordion gates have been pulled shut across entranceways and display windows and left that way. More and more, businesses have closed up or moved south into the malls of the white suburbs. Broadway's final destination in the north, at the edge of
Sample complete. Ready to continue?